It's KUOW's The Record. Thank you for tuning in today. I'm Bill Radke. After five police officers were killed last week in Dallas, the head of Seattle's police union did what a lot of people did. He reacted on Facebook. Ron Smith's post on the Seattle Police Officers Guild Facebook page said, in part, "The hatred of law enforcement by a minority movement is disgusting. Hashtag we shall overcome." Ron Smith is now stepping down from being the head of the Police Officers Guild. What was bad about what he said, and why does it matter who runs the Police Officers Union? We want to ask this of reporter Ansel Hertz, who covers the police beat at The Stranger. Ansel, good work and nice talking with you.
Thanks for having me.
You have said there are two sides to Ron Smith. What do you mean?
Well, when he came into office at SPOG, the police union, in 2014, he signaled that he was going to do things a little bit differently. He actually came to the Stranger offices and talked to us, even though there'd been kind of a history of antipathy there. And he signaled that he was open to reforms. He didn't join a lawsuit that attempted to block Department of Justice reforms. And then last year, he gave an interview with me where he said to cops in Seattle that if they don't adapt to the liberal, progressive climate of Seattle, that they should get out if their worldview just doesn't jibe with what Seattle's about.
Yeah, he said, there are places, I think, that have your worldview. They may be disappearing, but go work there.
Exactly. And that was stunning to a lot of people. It was stunning to the mayor's office. And so I think there was some movement on his part to try to change the direction of SPOG a little bit, which has always been kind of a circle the wagons culture. That's what people say. But we've gotten to this point now where he's resigning in part because over the past year, I think he's kind of reverted to form for SPOG. He's been posting things on Facebook repeatedly, things like the Obama administration is waging war on police. That was something he posted last summer. He took it down after it was condemned and called out because actually police fatalities under the Obama administration are lower than previous presidents.
Well, let's talk about what he said on Facebook most recently. He said the hatred of law enforcement by a minority movement is disgusting. Later, he said he meant to say that it's disgusting that a small segment of society perpetuates violence toward law enforcement officers across this country. Why couldn't he make that clarification and keep his job?
I think the SPOG membership, the rank and file police officers of Seattle, were just kind of fed up with Ron and his seemingly impulsive desire to just get on Facebook and say whatever he was thinking. It just got him in trouble time and time again. Councilmember Tim Burgess said that he thinks the SPOG's leadership has kind of been its own worst enemy in that regard. So I think the pressure actually came from within SPOG. That's what I've heard.
So speaking of SPOG, we throw that acronym out, Seattle. We're talking about the Seattle Police Officers Guild, the union. I'm not sure I understand the importance of the president of the guild. Is he or she just supposed to negotiate employment contracts or say nice things on Facebook? Like, how much does that person matter?
It's a hugely important position in this city if you are concerned about policing and crime. The SPOG president negotiates a roughly 80-page contract with the city. In fact, SPOG members are voting on the new version of that contract right now. Mm-hmm. And that contract contains all kinds of really technical but really important limits on civilian oversight in Seattle, the ability for the department to have civilians investigate officers when they engage in misconduct. There are time limits on those investigations. There are all kinds of really technical things. There are multiple avenues of appeal for officers when they do something wrong. Reformers have said that there should only be one avenue of appeal. So there are all of those kinds of things. But beyond that, I think SPOG and its rhetoric is a window into what the rank and file officers are feeling, or at least a certain segment. And
is it though? Because they just kicked him out for saying something that they apparently don't agree with.
Well, and again, it's hard to know whether that was sort of done from a PR perspective, like, uh-huh, you know, he's really bringing us some bad attention at a critical time right now, or whether there's real genuine disagreement. It's hard to know because SPOG is pretty opaque and they don't really talk to us very much. But, you know, the SPOG position is just incredibly important because of the contract, and just because That is the voice of the rank and file police officers in Seattle.
Talking with The Stranger's Ansel Hertz. The big picture here, as you know, many of us know, the federal government has ordered Seattle Police Department to treat people more fairly and use force more judiciously. Is that happening? And where does the guild fit in? But I guess the biggest question is that listeners want to know, is that happening? Are those changes happening?
Right. Well, the federal monitor who has been appointed through that process has given SPD a lot of good marks in his assessments. His name is Merrick Bob, and he does these periodic studies of use of force and the quality of SPD's investigations into use of force. And he's basically given them good marks. And so the Obama administration has said that SPD can actually be a national model for reform and that it's moving towards compliance with this consent decree. On the other hand, the monitor has also found that the levels of distrust of the African-American community in Seattle in the Seattle Police Department have actually increased. Other groups in Seattle have more trust in SPD since the reform process has begun, but that gap hasn't closed for the Black community. And I think that's a sign that something is wrong, and that even if things behind the scenes might be getting better, that hasn't translated into greater trust and more confidence that SPD is actually treating people fairly.
Okay, we will follow those federally mandated reform efforts. We will follow the debate that's going on right now over how to hold police officers accountable. We've got that whole thing with the mayor basically dismissing a couple of people. Lots more to say on that. Meanwhile, it's the vice president now moves up to being the president of the guild. Kevin Stuckey, is that his name? And as you just told us, Ansel, it's kind of hard to say what someone's going to do in their term. Ron Smith has been hard to figure out for you, and so we'll just have to keep following it.
Yeah. I mean, Kevin's been on the CPC, the Community Police Commission, for a while now, and he's been praised by other members of the Community Police Commission for being pretty down-to-earth and collaborative and helpful in that process. But he also, last year, he threatened to quit at one point when the CPC was considering pushing forward with reform legislation, pushing past the mayor. So we'll see what happens.
We'll watch it with the help of reporter Ansel Hertz with The Stranger covering the police beat there. Ansel, thanks for coming in and filling us in.
Thanks.
It's KUOW's The Record, KUOW 94.9 FM, Seattle. KUOW's The Record. Thanks for joining us. I'm Bill Radke. Donald J. Trump is the presumptive Republican nominee.
We will have so much winning if I get elected that you may get bored with winning. Believe me.
It's too much winning. But there is an 11th hour battle behind the scenes that could deny Trump the Republican nomination, and some members of Washington State's delegation are playing a big role, as KUOW's David Hyde reports.
This year's Republican convention will be packed with all of the usual pomp and political theater. Trump is even talking about a winner's night to showcase celebrities who back him. But there's a chance for some authentic drama this year, if this Washington State woman has anything to say about it.
Not a party insider.
But Gina Blanchard Reed is a delegate to the convention, and she also serves on the convention's Rules Committee, which will ask a serious question this week. Should an elected delegate be free to vote for the candidate of their choice?
Since the founding of the GOP, up until 1976, delegates were free to vote their conscience.
And Blanchard Reed says that system made sense.
You know, just like when we elect representatives, we want them to consider the thoughts of their constituents. But the person that we elect does have their own individual conscience, and I think that's where this issue is coming to the forefront.
So why is this suddenly a matter of conscience for some Republicans?
I've received literally, I can't even count now, the stacks, a couple reams of paper, of emails, people, lifelong Republicans that are very concerned about the presumptive nominee.
Donald Trump.
And we will make America great again.
Blanchard Reed says a lot of Republicans tell her they simply don't believe him, although she's quick to add.
That does not mean that the result would change, but it would be more of a free will vote.
Blanchard Reed and others say this issue of conscience is so important that the Rules Committee alone shouldn't decide it. They say it should go to a full vote on the convention floor. And if that happens, she says, anything's possible. But other Washington State Republicans tell me Donald Trump got the most votes and they're still confident that he's going to be their nominee. In Seattle, I'm David Hyde, KUOW News.
The Rules Committee makes a decision this week. The Republican convention itself kicks off Monday. It's July 11th, this coming Monday in Cleveland. And this year, KUOW News will be there, so you will too. On KUOW's The Record, now let's talk about the life of the Seattle area worker. Some REI employees say they cannot make plans and they cannot make enough money when they get scheduled to work short, unpredictable shifts. A group of those workers met earlier this week at City Hall to discuss the issue of secure scheduling and to talk about forming a union. The spokesperson for United Food and Commercial Workers Union, Local 21, Tom Geiger, told me one complaint part-time retail workers have is called clopening.
It's just basically a word around putting closing and opening together in the same word, meaning if you're scheduled for a shift where you close a retail store, for instance, and the next shift that the store opens on, you're also scheduled for that. That is clopening. And it can be a real burden on somebody if you actually close at 11 at night and you open at 7 in the morning and you have to commute to and from work on a bus. You can kind of put it together and see how that would be pretty difficult. So that's what clopening is.
You also say workers are being burdened by something you call just-in-time scheduling. What do you mean by that?
Right, so just-in-time scheduling is something that exists now across our culture and in particular a lot in retail work, and that is employers are looking to set up a schedule that maximizes the number of workers at work exactly when they want that and then minimizes the number of workers there maybe an hour or two later when they don't want as many workers. And that's just challenging for workers because you end up getting very short shifts. Which added together don't end up adding up to full-time work.
What kind of burden does scheduling like this place on workers?
Well, the improvement that we'd see, I think, with a policy like this is that people would be able to plan and predict their life outside of work a little bit, schedule a time to meet with a kid's teacher at school or schedule a doctor's appointment, figure out what committee they can participate in church, whatever it may be. So there's a predictability element there. And the other is even if you needed to go out and get a second part-time job to make those hours add up to pay your rent, if you've got more advanced notice for scheduling and some more predictable, dependable notice for that shift, you might be able to go out and get that second job. So it's just some more security for workers in a relatively insecure market.
Well, how would it affect businesses if the city made them stay staffed up at times when the businesses know they're typically not busy enough to justify the staff?
Yes, so this is really about a balance, I think, trying to reach a balance. The system's a little out of whack right now, and this is trying to course correct that, I think, to make retail work a little better for workers and to represent that that issue.
So how would the city strike that balance you're talking about? What do you want to see?
Probably something like a couple weeks advance notice of what your schedule would be like instead of a few days. Trying to see if there's a way to offer more hours to workers who are already employed someplace as a part-time worker before that employer offers or basically goes out and hires new additional part-time staff. And then the third would be a minimum shift time to have a, let's say, a four-hour minimum shift so somebody doesn't get scheduled for 2 hours of work on a day. And the last point is relating to that clopening point earlier, there being a minimum number of hours between a shift, let's say 8 hours between a shift.
We spoke to a Seattle business owner who basically said, these requirements you want on top of the higher minimum wage, you're killing us.
Again, I think that most people out there would see the plight of retail workers in particular in America as some pretty severe situation, income inequality, whatever you want to call it. These other things, paid sick days, a higher minimum wage, they're not just in Seattle, right? I mean, Seattle may be a place where we started some of those things across the country, but you really see it growing across the country as a way to improve the lives of workers a little bit. So a little more predictable hours, a little more money per hour, a paid sick day. And when you look at the Seattle economy, you know, it certainly is going pretty well, and records show that actually when you improve wages and working conditions, it tends to raise the boats as opposed to sink the boats.
Tom, there are times when governments tell businesses what to do. You can't discriminate against a protected class, et cetera. And there are times when governments say, it's a private business. Go find a job that's a better fit for you. How do you know which side of that line it's time to be on?
Well, I mean, I think that I know it partly by just going out and talking to a bunch of workers. And generally, when I talk to workers, many of whom are part-time, in those conversations with workers that are part-time and people that don't have a union, and the key there is in a union job, you're going to generally have a better voice and a schedule and predictability and hours. Not perfect, but just generally better. But in retail work, more of those are non-union than union. And we've gone to an extreme in the country and here locally around that. So I think that I get a sense by getting out there on the street and talking to people and things are out of whack, and this just pushes it back more towards the middle.
Tom Geiger, Communication Director with United Food and Commercial Workers Union Local 21. You heard him say he wants to raise the boats of Seattle workers who are struggling. It is so much more expensive to live here than it used to be. Imagine if you took a middle-class family from 60 years ago and plopped them into the city today. How much different would their lifestyle be? Where would they be able to live? KUOW's Emily Fox went to figure out whether the middle-class lifestyle her grandparents had will ever be achievable again in Seattle.
I grew up in a town in Michigan where the average house is worth about $125,000 today, and rent goes for about half of what it is in Seattle. So needless to say, I was a little shocked when I was thinking about moving here a few months ago, because it's going to be expensive.
Oh, I think about you so much, Emmy. I hope everything's going well.
That's my grandma. She's back in Michigan these days, but she and my grandfather were born and raised in Seattle.
You know, things have changed so much, Emmy. I think our apartment on, I want to say 9th Avenue, it was over by Seattle U when we were first married. I think that was like $20 a month.
My late grandfather was an assistant math professor at Seattle U in the late 50s. And shortly after that $20 a month apartment, he upgraded and bought a beautiful 3,000 square foot duplex in Capitol Hill for my grandma, my mom, and her three other siblings. And grandpa was a fixer, so he converted the duplex into a single family home that had 5 bedrooms and 4 bathrooms. He bought that house on one income for about $16,000. That house is now worth more than $1.5 million.
There's 5 bedrooms, so we each have an office. We have a bedroom, we have a guest room, and now one room's a yoga room.
Shelly McIntyre and her husband Scott have owned my grandpa's old house for 27 years now, and they had the luxury to really spread out. They're empty nesters. Shelly manages real estate, and Scott is a family doctor.
Well, we moved here with 2 young kids. They were, 1 and 4? And it was a bit of a reach. As we were then, we couldn't buy it today.
The house has increased in value by about 5 times since they bought in the late 80s. It's in a great neighborhood. It's near the Arboretum and Volunteer Park. Most of the homes here are 2 stories with ornate designs and details and have big porches. Since this colonial-style home was a duplex at first, it has extra things like 2 living rooms, 2 fireplaces, and 2 wood banister stairways that work their way up to the second floor from different parts of the house. And the upstairs view looks like something out of an M.C. Escher drawing.
Here's one set of stairs.
But if my grandfather was still working as an assistant math professor and supporting a wife and 4 kids in today's world, where would he be able to live? What would that house look like? Claudette Meyer is a realtor for Windermere Real Estate. She's showing me a house my grandfather could afford in today's market. It's also a duplex, like what my grandpa bought, but it's 14 miles farther south in Skyway.
I mean, it's only 1,480 square feet. Versus
so half.
Yes, half the square footage that your grandparents' home offers. Everyone will be a little snug here. I mean, this is 3 bedrooms.
Hello, bunk beds. Goodbye, storage space. This duplex is surrounded by equally small, one-story, bland, boxy houses. The yard is overgrown with grass and weeds.
A blank canvas, they would say.
Which translates to what?
Which translates to sweat equity.
Assistant math professors at Seattle U today make about $60,000 to $70,000 a year. In a kind of best-case scenario, my grandpa would be able to afford a house that was about $320,000 in today's world. And in today's world, Meyer says that would only give my grandfather about 10 options for houses on the market in the city today that he could afford. And they're nothing like the home he once had. None of them have five or even four bedrooms. They're all half the size and are all pretty far from downtown.
You've got a big bunch here in the south end, Rainier Beach and south. And that's really, those are your options in the city.
Granted, lifestyles have changed since the late 50s when my grandpa bought. It's rare for parents to have four kids these days, and it's a luxury when a mother doesn't have to work. But my grandparents were middle class back in their day, and the life that they were able to make for themselves is becoming something for only the rich in Seattle, like Meyer's clients who work as
computer programmers, software developers, attorneys, people who are working in the biotech industry.
Meyer says middle class workers like nurses and teachers can really only afford homes in the far outskirts of town, and the artists and service workers are being pushed even farther north and south than that. So can the middle-class lifestyle my grandparents had ever be achievable again in Seattle?
I won't say it will never be achievable in Seattle again, but it's certainly questionable. I don't think that on an income of $70,000 with four children to accommodate in a home, that you could afford that in Seattle at this day and time.
So right now, it's not achievable.
I don't think so. No.
I'm Emily Fox, KUOW News.
And you'll find photos of Emily's grandpa's old house and the house he can afford today on our website, KUOW.org. It's KUOW's The Record. We're really glad you're listening to this. I'm Bill Radke. When the big one hits, and it will, your child may be at school, and that school might not be safe. One in three Washington kids go to school in earthquake-prone areas, in buildings that were built before we built buildings to not fall down in earthquakes. And today, the Seattle Times reports the state does not require seismic upgrades to those buildings or even inspections. Reporter Sandy Doughton's here to tell us more. Hi, Sandy.
Hi.
Why would we not require those upgrades and at least the inspections to tell us what the problem is?
Well, you know, it just has not been a priority here in Washington. And my impression is that that's because our leaders, our leadership, our officials are basically gambling that it won't happen on their watch. And they're facing so many other pressures to fund education. Right now, our school system is struggling to just come up with enough money to fund its basic mission, and school upgrades will be expensive. But I was really surprised at the lawmakers we spoke to, the legislators, who said they don't even want to do a survey. They don't even want to look because basically they're afraid of what they'll find.
Yeah, that one guy said, what, are we liable now to fix what we found?
That's
wow.
Right. That's right. It has been a real head in the sand kind of attitude.
Yeah. Head in the sand. So is it mainly a lack of money? That because you write that California, Oregon, British Columbia is finding a way to pay for this in their schools? What's the big difference between us and them?
I think the big difference here has been a lack of leadership. We just haven't had anybody step forward to make this a priority like happened in Oregon. And there hasn't been the grassroots pressure from parents that occurred in British Columbia, for example.
And why do you think that would be?
I'm not sure. I think, you know, we haven't had one of these major earthquakes in anyone's lifetime who's still around today.
And it seemed like a big one in, what was that, 2001?
In 2001, yeah, that was very, very small. That was 2,000 times less powerful than the kind of quake that we can expect in the future. So I think there's just a level of denial that it will happen and how damaging it will be.
Okay, so let's talk about the scale of the problem. How And numbers will make our eyes glaze over. But do you have, what sense do you have of how big the problem is, the schools and students who are at what kind of risk?
Well, the short answer is that it's impossible to know because there has been no survey of schools in Washington.
Right.
So there's no good data on which schools are at risk. But my colleague Daniel Gilbert looked at school databases, and he came up with some figures that almost 400,000 kids attend these schools that you mentioned that were built before seismic building codes were implemented statewide.
In the 40s, right?
It was actually in 1975 that the codes were implemented statewide. Some places like Seattle adopted them earlier. Okay. Now, all of those schools are not dangerous because some of them have been retrofitted. And in richer school districts like Seattle, like Everett, most of those older schools have been retrofitted. But in less affluent districts like Port Angeles and Aberdeen, none of their older schools have been retrofitted.
Yeah, I want to highlight that. So are you saying rich districts, rich school districts will be made safe from earthquake where poor school districts will not?
That's what's happened in Washington State so far.
And there's no big outcry, serious outcry about that?
There hasn't been, and I think maybe people are not even aware of that. I think people don't, you know, once again, they don't realize what the risk is, and there's no way of saying when it's going to happen, so it's easy to, you know, put it out of your mind.
So can you say generally how safe the biggest school district in the state is, Seattle?
The Seattle school district is fairly safe because here in Seattle, we approve every levy, we approve every bond issue, and a lot of that money has gone to upgrade old schools. And Seattle has some of the oldest schools in the state.
What about schools in the tsunami inundation zone?
Yeah, that's a real problem because it's very hard to even build a school that will stand up to a tsunami. There's only one school building on the Washington coast that was built to withstand a tsunami, and that opened recently at a small school called Acosta Elementary near Westport. In most other areas, what you have to do is basically relocate the school out of the tsunami zone.
So you're not seeing an initiative, a lawsuit threat, anything that you're reporting that's really changing this situation?
No, there's no, there doesn't seem to be a constituency. There's not parents agitating for this. And you know, believe me, after the quake, after the tsunami, then there will be lawsuits.
In the meantime, how can people find out how safe their school is?
It's not easy because the information is not readily available. But if they look at our story, go to theseattletimes.com, you can see we posted a database from the state with information on every school building, when it was built, what type of soil it's built on, and how likely it is to experience a damaging earthquake. And so you can start there and identify basically the age of the school building. And if it was built before 1975, if it was built before the mid-90s, then it might be cause for concern. And at that point, what you have to do is go to the district and find out, has the school been upgraded and what kind of construction is it?
Seattle Times reporters Sandy Doughton and Daniel Gilbert wrote, "Is Your Child Safe?" It is the second in a continuing Seattle Times series about Washington's preparedness for a major earthquake. And you can read the full article in today's paper. You can find out more about how to assess the safety of your local school. We're going to tweet out that link right now. Join us on Twitter at KUOW. Sandy Doughton, thank you so much.
Thanks for your interest.
It's The Record. 94.9 Seattle. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. More than 9 million Americans identify as multiracial. It took a standardized test for Radioactive's Noelle Gasca to ask whether she was one of those 9 million.
On a sunny morning during my junior year of high school, I was taking the SAT when I got to a question that left me stumped. It basically asked, "What race are you?" I started scanning through the boxes listed on the page. African American? Pacific Islander? No. Hispanic? Well, kinda. White? Sorta. My mind raced. I checked Hispanic, but I felt like a fraud. My mom is white, and my dad is Mexican American. My parents got divorced when I was 3. After that, my brother and I were raised by my mom and my grandma. And when we would go visit my dad's side of the family, everything was foreign to me. I felt like there was this entire side of myself that was foreign to me. That's why during the SAT, I hesitated to check the Hispanic box. I never expected my mom to teach me about my Hispanic heritage, but I did blame my dad for this lost feeling inside of me. So I decided to talk to him when he came up to visit. So, you know, I've talked to you about, like, the box. And so I want to know, like, what box do you think I should check and why?
When it comes to the question of which box you would check, I mean, to me, there's no question that you should check Hispanic. I guess because I don't see you as any different than me when I grew up.
He didn't see me as any different from him? How could he say that? We were raised in two completely different cultures.
I've always been able to identify as being Mexican-American or Hispanic because we ate tortillas and beans and rice and liked it.
As a kid, I hated beans and rice, which was always a staple at Gasca family parties. So I was starving, but I also had no idea what anyone was talking about. My dad could relate, though, because he didn't speak Spanish either. I'd always assumed that my dad didn't want to learn Spanish when he was growing up, that he just wanted to assimilate. But that's not true. There just wasn't any time.
My dad would get up at 3 o'clock in the morning to start his job. And when he came home at 3 in the afternoon, would take a nap and then get up. And if my mom was working a swing shift, which a lot of years she did, he would feed us. And then it was football, basketball, or baseball practice. Mm-hmm. And we'd come home. And, you know, and then it was time for bed.
My dad didn't learn to speak Spanish until recently. At this point in the conversation, I was feeling pretty defeated. My dad was telling me that I could check the Hispanic box. But the more he talked to me, the less I felt like I could. Talking to my dad made me realize how different we really are. We were in the living room, and at that point, my mom came in.
Can you sit here, Mom? The next question I'm asking Dad is about, you know, when you guys got married.
Okay. My mom and my dad don't talk much about the time before they were married. I know that for my mom's family, her marrying someone who wasn't white was a bit of a scandal. But I wanted to know, did she ever think about having this conversation with her future children?
I never thought about race. I never thought about the fact that you guys would be biracial. I mean, that was not part of my consciousness. And so when the first time, you know, you asked me, or the first time that conversation came up with you, it was kind of a shock to me. And I felt like I somehow had failed you because you didn't feel like you fit in both places.
A big reason why I never felt like I fit in both places is because I know I look different from my mom and my dad. My ethnicity has always been a sort of guessing game for my classmates, my teachers, and random people at the grocery store. I have dark, curly brown hair and big brown eyes. I have this generic ethnic look to me. I started to associate being mistaken for Greek or Thai as not being Mexican enough. I thought that if I looked like the perfect Mexican-American teenage girl I'd created in my head, then I would be justified in checking the Hispanic box. But I didn't feel that way. I felt like I was failing.
I feel like I'm a bad...
Mexican?
Yeah.
No, you're not. You don't have to... I don't know why you're... You know why, if you feel bad, you don't have to feel bad. Noelle, being Hispanic or checking that box doesn't mean that you should have been riding a burro and wearing a serape.
He had a point, but I was still so frustrated. There was still a part of me that did blame my dad, and I knew he could tell.
Please don't blame it on me. I'd like to rectify it, you know? It's something that we can learn together, you know? I don't look at my dad and say, why didn't you teach us? You know what I mean? I mean, because it's my responsibility, you know, just like it is yours.
Yeah, I get that. I know that if I want to truly identify as Mexican-American, I have to start putting in more of an effort. And I have to stop living in the past. I thought that by having that conversation with my parents, I would be able to wake up the next morning, look myself in the mirror, and proudly say that I'm a Mexican-American, that I am biracial. But that didn't happen. It still hasn't happened. And I don't know when it will happen or if it will happen or even if it does, if I'll have an easier time checking that box. For Radioactive, I'm Noelle Gasca.
Radioactive is KUOW's Youth Media Workshop, and you will find more youth-produced stories on Facebook at Radioactive Youth Media. This is KUOW. Here's a story that could change the way you spend a lot of your time. Matthew Inman was no fitness buff. No, he was mostly in front of computer screens. Then he broke up with his girlfriend. He was feeling like making changes. He settled on running. He can run while he's thinking up his popular webcomic, The Oatmeal. Now, Matthew told me running does sometimes get him into trouble, like the time he was in Japan training for an ultra marathon.
And I went on this run where it was, I think it was a 17 or 18 mile run. And it was one of the hottest days I can recall. You know, it was over 100 degrees, full humidity. And didn't bring enough water and wound up in a bamboo forest by myself, dehydrated, miserable, hating running as a sport, hating myself, hating everything that I saw for the most part. And came around a corner and I got chased by these hornets that I'd encountered. They're called the Japanese giant hornet, tsutsumebachi or something. It means like sparrow bee because they're the size, they're not actually the size of sparrows, but they're huge. They have a quarter inch stinger that can melt human flesh. They kill about 30 people a year in Japan, making them the most dangerous animal in Japan. And I got chased by them and I was running and it was like the apex of misery. I'm being chased by giant hornets in 100 degree temperatures. I have no water. I'm miserable. I'm like, why am I doing this stupid sport? And suddenly, you know, I came around the corner and there was a vending machine and it had a purple drink, you know, a bunch of sugary drinks. And that drink was this purple sort of fizzy soda. And I drank it and I felt better. And it's at that moment, the run completely turned around and a lightning storm came in, which made all the bees leave the forest. The temperature dropped. The wind started howling. The bamboo was cracking and snapping and wheezing. And I was running and maybe it was just adrenaline or exhaustion or fatigue or whatever. But I had this sort of moment of like, this is why I run. This is the emotional core of why I run. I mean, I run for a lot of reasons. I run to eat. I run because if my life is falling apart, as long as I squeeze in a run that day, everything's going well. But the Japanese run in Nagoya was very much like, okay, this is sort of why I'm alive and not necessarily running. So my book came about from a lot of that feeling.
I really should tell you and the listeners that the Matthew Inman that I am happy for is the healthy running Matthew Inman. The Matthew Inman I identify with is your former self because I don't run. I don't want to run. Running hurts. Runners don't smile. I mean, you have some work to do with me. I mean, you even write about losing toenails and, you know, shin splints and foot blisters. Isn't your body begging you to stop doing what you're doing?
It is, but the reward for me is greater than that because I would love to tell you that I run because I want to be fit and healthy and I want to live a long life and all of those reasons people tell you they work out. That's not why I work out for the most part.
No?
I run for the most part so that I can eat whatever I want because I eat garbage. My face is a garbage disposal.
Really?
I call myself a walking garbage disposal. So if you run distances that are extreme, you can eat whatever you want. You can have corn dogs for breakfast and for lunch and for dinner, and it doesn't matter.
That works for you.
That works for me. And I realized like that's kind of why I got into running in the first place was I want to lose weight, and I'm not able to control dieting. I have no portion control. Like I said, I'm just like this monster around food. But I can control my exercise. I love exercising.
You can be a monster around exercise.
Yes, yes. So that's kind of what got me into running was that like, okay, I can't control my eating, but I can control my ability to run up and down mountains all day. So let's do it that way.
Are you sure, though, if you got some therapy and some mindful meditation that you wouldn't be less of a garbage eater and less of a toenail losing shin splint having runner?
Yeah, I'd imagine probably therapy. I'm sure there's a much quicker way to go about this than the way I'm doing it. But it works for me. I find peace this way. And, you know, even though it's, I actually look at running as almost a vice to some of the degrees at which I do it. Because oftentimes you'll do it to avoid people. You'll do it to avoid your problems. But if it's a vice that I'm going to have, it seems like a good one to have.
That's interesting. It's like an indulgence then.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's not responsible to go visit your family on Thanksgiving and be like, well, guys, I'm going to go run 10 miles. When really, the reason I'm running 10 miles is I love them, but I don't want to get trapped in a room with a bunch of awkward relatives, and I'd rather go run. In that regard, it's a bit of a vice for me.
I love your self-awareness. You seem that you do have some mindfulness about you.
Yeah. The other thing, you're talking about meditation. I can't meditate. Like, trying to get me to meditate is like giving espresso to a Pomeranian and being like, sit still. Like, it doesn't happen. I'm not built to sit quietly in a room. With running, because it's a repetitive act that you do that requires a little bit of discomfort, depending on how hard you're running, you can actually kind of meditate from it. So like the closest I've ever come to meditation was through distance running. And you can apply that to an elliptical or swimming or, I don't know, knitting or anything that you do, you know, repetition for a long period of time. You can kind of get that sense of peace.
Let's talk about hitting the wall. For me, the wall is between me and running, as I've said. Do you ever hit a wall? And what do you do about it?
So this whole running thing started from a comic that I wrote called The Terrible Wonderful Reasons Why I Run Long Distances. And in that, the opening chapter, I talk about how I don't believe in the wall. I believe in multiple walls. And the thing I don't like about the metaphor of a wall is it's one solid, immovable object that you see and you cannot get past. And I abandoned that and I came up with a better thing, in my opinion, that describes my strife with running. And that was what I call the blurch. Which is, I drew it as this sort of fat cherub monster who floats behind me. He's got little wings. And if he catches me, I will become him. And I will become the former fat kid I was when I was younger. And so rather than running long distances or short distances or whatever distance and hitting this wall, you have this little monster who's following you. And if you slow down, he'll catch you. Not only that, he's sort of, you know, flying behind you, whispering things in your ear about why run when you can go have beer and nachos, or why keep hurting yourself when there's birthday cake? You can have birthday cake any hour of the day. And so the blurch has become my replacement for the wall and kind of this sort of spirit animal that I have.
So you have people like me saying don't run unless you're being chased, and you are being chased.
Figuratively, yes.
Figuratively by the blurch.
Yep.
Let's talk about marathons, because this summer is filled with 5Ks, 10Ks, half marathons, full marathons. You have your own marathon called the Blurch.
Beat the Blurch.
Beat the Blurch.
Yep.
How does that work?
So it's a standard marathon. It's out in the woods in Carnation. It's very pretty. It's a flat course. The difference with our marathon and others is we fixed a few things that I don't like. Race photos are free, because usually you get billed like crazy for race photos. The main difference, though, is that our marathon is... There's couches at every aid station that you can have a nap on. We give you birthday cake at every aid station.
Uh-huh.
There are people in giant blurch costumes and suits that chase you.
Good.
It's sort of like an irreverent take on a marathon. And, you know, if you get like a type A runner who's looking to PR or qualify for Boston, it's the wrong race. If you're the type of person who wears a, you know, a pizza costume to a race, this is where you should probably go.
A moment about marathons, and I'm going to express this. Listeners might hate me, you might hate me, but when I see a marathon and I'm stopped behind a marathon because it's happening and I didn't know it, I think, why don't you just run around Green Lake? What does your marathon have to do with me?
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you just climb stairs, or why do you have to get in my way? Just being honest.
I agree with you. I don't do most city marathons. I run in the woods by myself.
Uh-huh.
I don't post about my runs on Facebook. I don't post on Instagram. A lot of people don't do that. They run marathons because they want to show everyone they ran a marathon. That's why they do it. And me personally, I'm not that kind of runner. I run because it makes me feel better. I don't post my workouts on Facebook. So what you're seeing when you're stopped in your car and you're waiting and you have an important job to do and there's 10,000 runners in front of you, what you're seeing is 10,000 people who want to be on Facebook showing that they ran a marathon. So I'm in complete agreement with you.
Yeah, who knew? You don't hate me after all.
No, not at all.
I feel better.
I do still run the marathons because it is better to have a lot of people with you. It assigns kind of a point to a pointless sport. Running in circles in your neighborhood is pointless. It is depressing, it is lonely, and runners are starved and they are sullen. But if everybody's starved and sullen at the same time, it's a party. So that's kind of where a marathon comes from.
Matthew Inman, creator of the comic The Oatmeal and author of The Terrible and Wonderful Reasons Why I Run Long Distances. We're tweeting out a link to that comic right now. Inman has a marathon called Beat the Blurch. It takes place in Seattle September 17th and 18th. You can find out how to register at that link we just tweeted, at KUOW. And if you think we just missed the point of running just now, he and me, set us straight at KUOW. Now, here's something else that happens when people get athletic. At Major League Baseball's All-Star Game last night, as they always do, they sang the Canadian National Anthem. You know, why don't I bring in Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer right now? Hello, Vaughn.
Hiya, Bill.
Vaughn, I assume they sing the Canadian anthem because the major leagues have one team that's in Montreal, right?
It's in Toronto.
Toronto.
Blue Jays won the World Series twice.
Yes.
So, you know, they're a real team.
Sorry.
They did pretty well last year. But look, yeah, we get the Canadian national anthem. It's like when they play the hockey final. There's lots of American teams, so they sing the American. So very nice of Major League to recognize us. Very nice to invite a group of Canadian singers, the Canadian tenors from Vancouver, to come in and sing our national anthem. But man, oh man, did they trigger a controversy.
Mm-hmm. They got to the part with...
one of the guys changed the words.
He changed the words.
It's really funny. People really should see this on YouTube, because what you can see is that there's four tenors singing the Canadian national anthem. One of them changes the words, and the other three are going, dude, what the heck are you doing here?
Like, yes.
He didn't tell him he was going to do it either.
Yeah, they're really giving him the side eye for sure. So it's supposed to go with glowing hearts...
The part that they were singing, or that he was singing, was, "With glowing hearts we see thee rise, the true north strong and free."
Right.
He sings.
Here it is. I'll play it for you.
Come on, we're all brothers and sisters. All lives matter.
All lives matter to the great. There are writing problems there to begin with, but that's not why he was in trouble, as you say, Vaughn.
Yeah, the folks watched this in the States. They didn't even see that, but that part of the opening ceremonies did run in Canada, and social media exploded immediately. People raged, offended, a whole bunch of reasons. I mean, first of all, changing the national anthem is like, not done.
Yeah, it's not cool in America either.
Yeah, we do it by law, Bill, once in a while, but you don't do that. And they also, like, all lives matter to the great. This is actually, as you will know, an American political controversy being imported into the Canadian national anthem, and not in a way that everybody regards as appropriate. You'll be aware that the folks behind Black Lives Matter find all lives matter kind of misses the point, and it's insulting. So not only did he import an American political controversy into our national anthem, but he did it in a way that even Americans regard as offensive. The tenors have apologized. They've suspended him from the group. I see that baseball has said, hey, we didn't know this was coming. Nobody told us. We're sorry. But how often, Bill, do you get a headline that says lone wolf tenor suspended for singing the national anthem wrongly?
Yes, this is not Wolf Trap. This was the lone wolf in San Diego. And in this guy's, well, you can decide if it's his defense. He did hold up a sign in the performance saying all lives matter with the words "United We Stand" written on the back. So it seemed like he really thought about this. But he said in a response, "I've been so moved by the tragic loss of life lately, I hoped for a positive statement that would bring us all together, one love. That was my singular motivation when I said all lives matter. I am disturbed that people would attribute anything other than the purest of intentions to my actions. I weep for the senseless loss of life." He goes on and on, ending with, "Peace be with us all."
He's not helping himself. Most people, I think, including the other three tenors in the group, think that singing of the national anthem is not a place to be expressing your own personal political views. Leave that to the public platform, not to an event that's supposed to unite us all.
Right. By the way, later on KOW, you're going to meet the three women behind the founding of the Black Lives Matter movement. Today, they're talking about the cultural shift they've seen in the past few years, the frustration that's bubbled up in that time, and what they want to see change. So that's coming up on All Things Considered at 2 o'clock. We have a couple of more minutes left, Vaughn, and I wanted to ask you about this idea in a proposal in Vancouver that if you own a home and you keep it vacant, you might have to pay an extra tax. What's that about?
Mayor of Vancouver, Gregor Robertson, they did a survey earlier this year, and they found about 11,000 units of housing, so condominiums, apartments, houses, they determined deliberately left vacant as investments. The city has a shortage of rental property and came out with a proposal that they start charging another class of property tax, so a surcharge, in effect, on the property tax, if you're leaving your property deliberately vacant as an incentive to get you to either move into it yourself, sell it, or get somebody else to move in as a tenant. The provincial government has said, okay, we'll give it a try. They've called the legislature back this summer toward the end of the month. They're going to bring in the power for the city to do that. But there's a lot of unanswered questions about this bill. First of all, how do you define vacancy? And second of all, even if the property is deliberately left vacant, how do you catch them? Do you use snitches, inspectors? No one's really sure. So, you know, it's an interesting experiment, but I think it'll prove to be a controversial one as well. And no one is sure, Bill, whether this will actually add to the rental housing stock or only to the controversy around soaring house prices and shortage of rental property in Vancouver.
Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, thanks for filling us in.
Bye-bye, Bill.
You're listening to KUOW Seattle. Coming up, thousands of mourners have attended funeral services today for three of those officers killed in Dallas. This is Sandy Thompson, daughter of Officer Brent Thompson. Sandy said her father had to be away from the family at times, but he was always home for Christmas, and she always thought about his safety.
One thing I would always say to my dad when he walked out the door was, "Goodbye, Daddy. I love you. Be safe." And tonight we say our final, "Goodbye, Daddy. We love you. Be safe."
We're going to bring you more from those three funeral services this afternoon on KUOW's All Things Considered, begins at 2 o'clock. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke.